They'll arrive at your door as innocent as children, longing for the past.
And they'll walk out to the bleachers, sit in shirt sleeves on a perfect afternoon. They'll find they have reserved seats somewhere along one of the baselines where they sat when they were children and cheered their heroes. And they'll watch the game, and it'll be as if they'd dipped themselves in magic waters. The memories will be so thick, they'll have to brush them away from their faces. The one constant through all the years, Ray, has been baseball. America has rolled by like an army of steamrollers. It's been erased like a blackboard, rebuilt and erased again. But baseball has marked the time. This field, this game, is a part of our past, Ray. It reminds us of all that once was good, and it could be again.
I'm Lindsay.
I'm Jim.
Well, if you're joining us for the first time, we are so glad to have you here. And if you've listened before, thank you for tuning in again. This is a podcast that looks back on the decade of the 1980s. We talk about things that were important to us as children and what we look back on with fond memories as adults. Ultimately, this is a nostalgia podcast. Today we are waxing nostalgically about the game labeled America's pastime, baseball. But before we get to that, let's talk a little bit about our last episode and any feedback that we got. Did you get anything?
Lots of positive feedback. Everybody seems to love the Karate Kid. Some people were shocked that I say it's my favorite movie of the 80s.
Yes.
Much like you were.
Mm-hmm.
But ultimately, you know, we all have our favorite movies. And if you point out a movie to me that I like better, I will admit that Karate Kid is not my favorite movie. If you were to say to me The Goonies, I would say, I got to think about that one.
Oh, really? Yes. Okay. We need to review The Goonies.
Oh, we will.
The feedback that I got was, most people agreed with you, though, that it was like one of the best, if not the best, 80s movie.
Wow.
And that everybody loves Johnny.
Now they do. They didn't then.
Well, I can't go back then and ask them.
Everybody hated Johnny back then.
I mean,
then.
I can't go back to 1984 and ask people, hey, do you like Johnny? I mean, all I can do is...
You know what I can do? I can go back to 1986 and ask, who's Johnny?
Who's Johnny?
Short Circuit.
Oh, that's right. Who's There's Johnny? Another movie we need to review.
Sure.
I loved Short Circuit.
Yes. So, like you said, we are talking about baseball
All
today.
Right. Moving along. You're so excited. Like, you have to get to it, right?
I do. It's like a quarter burning a hole in my pocket.
Enough
back in the
with
80s
the small talk.
I've got to get to the Pac-Man machine. So, tomorrow's opening day. So, that's why we are talking baseball.
Well, now it's the 80s, and Brett is the greatest, and Bobby Bonds can play for everyone. Rose is at the vet, Rusty again is a Met, and the great Alexander is pitching again in Washington. I'm talking baseball, like Reggie, Queez, and Barry. Talking baseball, Carew and Gaylord Perry, Seaver, Garvey, Schmidt, and Vida Blue. And it's no fluke, they'll be with Willie, Mickey, and the Duke.
For those of you that don't know or may vaguely remember that song is called Talkin' Baseball, parentheses, Willie, Mickey, and the Duke.
So whoever wrote this song, I think also wrote the theme song to the TV show, was it The Fall Guy?
Yes.
that you love so much. And yes, it's like basically this, the theme song tells a story. I think the same guy wrote this song.
I don't think it was the same guy, but I think it's funny that you think that. Had you ever heard this song before?
No, never.
Before I just played it right then and there.
So, and let me just say, I come from a really big family of baseball fans. So, I mean, you act like this is like everybody knows this song. I've never heard this song before in my life.
So let me tell you about the song.
Okay.
Do you mind?
Kind of.
This was... This song was written and performed by Terry Cashman in 1981. So it is an 80s song. It's an 80s song about baseball. It was released during... Did you know that in 1981 there was a Major League Baseball strike? And they started in June. Like, the players struck in June.
I actually did not know that. Or if I did, I had forgotten.
I thought you were going to call me out on my bad grammar. They struck. They went on strike.
Yeah.
In June, and it actually lasted until August for about 2 months. So during that time, Terry Cashman decided to write and record this song. And so the 1981 season was a weird season. They talked about, or not they talked about, what they actually did was, because baseball started in April and went to June, they took the first half winners, and then it started back again in August, and they went to October. And they whoever finished in first place in each division the first half would play whoever finished first in each division in the second half in like a mini playoffs, and then they would play the league championship series and then the World Series, which really the Cardinals, my Cardinals, you know, I'm from St. Louis, you know, we love our Cardinal baseball there. They got hosed because they actually had the best record overall in their division, but they didn't win either the first half or the second half. So they didn't even make the playoffs. And the same thing with the Cincinnati Reds.
The who?
The Cincinnati Reds. They also had the best record in their division, but they did not win either the first half or the second half of baseball. So they got cheated too. And we ended up with a Dodgers-Yankees World Series like that hadn't happened before.
And who won?
The Dodgers actually won.
That Tommy Lasorda?
Tommy Lasorda. That was the year of Fernando Mania. Fernando Valenzuela was a rookie pitcher from Mexico, and he just started off on fire.
So Terry Cashman, is that a name that I should have heard before?
I don't think so. So he wrote this song. He played it. They started playing it during the strike, and it became popular enough at that time among baseball fans that he started recording alternate versions of the song, which focused on the history of a single major league franchise. So the first time that I actually heard this song was actually the Cardinals version. It wasn't the talking baseball version.
So did you think it was just like something special for
St.
Louis?
I did. Yeah. And then I heard, you know, the original, you know, but this song actually, it was big enough that it ended up charting on the U.S. Billboard chart for easy listening, which I would have thought would have been the adult contemporary chart, but I guess not. But it charted at number 28. So if you listen to it, it's kind of catchy. It's kind of fun, right?
It is. I want to hate on it, but it's super catchy and it's playing in my head right now.
I let Emmy listen to it before I came up here to do this, and she was loving it.
She was
singing along right with it. Yeah.
Wow.
So some of our listeners might recognize this because Cashman actually parodied, is that how you say that? He made a parody of his own song in the Simpsons episode, Homer at the Bat, where Mr. Burns had a softball team, and he called it Talking Softball.
That's funny.
And I remember that because they talked about, you know, Ozzie Smith was in the episode, Ken Griffey Jr. was in the episode, and he had something happen to his jaw, so he's talking about Ken Griffey's grotesque jaw. It's really funny. You'll have to go back and find the clips of that. But some of the historical figures, a lot of historical figures mentioned in this song.
So can I?
Yeah, jump right in.
Give you a chance to maybe take a deep breath. Yogi Berra, Stan Musial, Hank Aaron, Jackie Robinson, Ted Williams, George Brett, Pete Rose, Reggie Jackson, Mike Schmidt, and Tom Seaver. That is along with, of course, Willie, Mickey, and the Duke.
You know who the Duke is?
I thought it was Ted Williams.
No. But that kind of would make a little bit of sense, because to me, Ted Williams was always like the John Wayne of baseball.
Yeah, that's why
John Wayne. But Duke Snider, he was a center fielder for the Brooklyn Dodgers. So in the 50s, New York had three teams, and their center fielders were like pretty much the three best players in baseball prior to Hank Aaron. And then when Hank Aaron came, he was one of the best.
So is it Willie Hayes Mays?
No, it is Willie Mays, the Say Hey Kid. Willie Mays played in New York. He played for the Giants. Mickey Mantle obviously played for center field for the Yankees.
Okay.
And Duke Snider played center field for the Brooklyn Dodgers. But what's really cool about that song is the last verse. So it's all about the history, but that last verse written in 1981 talks about all the players in the early 80s, like George Brett and Pete Rose and Reggie Jackson and Vita Blue and Mike Schmidt and all those guys. So that's a really cool stuff.
Well, if that song didn't put you in the mood to reminisce about baseball, this one will. It's a brown-eyed handsome man. Anyone can understand the way I feel. Oh, put me in cold. I'm ready to play today. Put me in cold. I'm ready to play today. Look at me. I can be Santa. This gives me chicken skin.
Chicken skin?
Yeah, chicken skin.
What does... Goosebumps?
Yeah.
You call that chicken skin?
Yeah, it's chicken skin.
Is that a Southern thing or is that just a you thing?
I think it's probably just a me
thing.
Okay. I love this song.
So, for those of you who don't know, and if you don't know, you're either young or... If you live through the 80s, you should be smacked. That song's called Center Field by John Fogerty. And that I remember hearing that as a kid, just thinking that was the greatest song
ever made. This is such a good song.
It is. So, Center Field by John Fogerty, it's off his 1984 album, which was also appropriately named Center Field. The song wasn't actually released until March of 1985, right before the start of the baseball season. On a side note, 1985 was probably my favorite year, my favorite baseball year.
Why?
As a kid. Because the Cardinals were really good. They were really fun to watch. They had all kinds of speed. Vince Coleman was a rookie. He'd lead the league in stolen bases as a rookie with 110 stolen bases. They were just fun to watch, and they went to the World Series.
Okay.
So this song only hit number 44 on the Billboard Hot 100.
That's a travesty.
It is, but it did hit number 4 on the U.S. Billboard Top Rock Tracks. The song's been honored by the National Baseball Hall of Fame in 2010, where John Fogerty became the only musician celebrated at the Hall of Fame induction ceremony.
The only musician that year, or the only musician period?
From what I read, the only musician period. You'd have thought maybe the guy who wrote Take Me Out to the Ball Game may have been honored at the Hall of Fame. He's probably dead by the time the Hall of Fame came around, but... So, John Fogerty... Obviously, he's like Brian Cashman, where he loves center fielders, Willie, Mickey, and the Duke. He mentioned center fielders in the song, Willie Mays, Ty Cobb, and Joe DiMaggio. You know another song that Joe DiMaggio's mentioned in?
Yeah, Billy Joel, We Didn't Start the Fire.
Was he named? He was, wasn't he?
I think so.
Joe DiMaggio was named in... Simon and Garfunkel, Mrs. Robinson.
Well, to me, he has an extra layer of notoriety just because of Marilyn Monroe.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Mr. Coffee.
What? Oh, I don't even know about Mr. Coffee. What's the story there?
He did the commercial? He was the pitch man for Mr. Coffee, yeah. Other historical figures potentially referenced but not said by name are Jackie Robinson and Shoeless Joe Jackson. Shoeless Joe, when he sings Don't Say It Ain't So, because that's what a little boy said outside the courthouse after...
Allegedly.
Yeah, that's true. It could just be an old wives' tale. Jackie Robinson's not mentioned, but Fogerty talks about when he says round and third and headed for home as a brown-eyed handsome man, he said he always pictured that in his head as being Jackie Robinson. Mm. So I thought that was kind of cool. He also mentions the, have you ever heard of the poem Casey at the Bat?
Of course, because of at Disney, at Magic Kingdom.
Casey's Hot Dogs?
Yes.
Of course, you could relate everything back to Disney.
Of course I can.
You're like me, I can relate everything back to 80s lyrics or any kind of song lyrics, really. So yeah, he talks about, I spent some time with the Mudville Nine, which was the name of the team in the poem. And he says, I took some lumps when the Mighty Case struck out. Mighty Casey was the team's best hitter. The hometown fans are sure he's going to come through when he comes up to bat in the bottom of the ninth with the team down two and two runners on. And he strikes out.
Wah, wah.
He fails. We will maybe revisit something like this poem later on when we talk about a certain movie. But what do you think? I mean, you said earlier you love the song. Do you hear it when you go to the ballpark?
Yeah, I think every time I've ever gone to see the Braves play, I feel like I have heard that song at some point while I'm there.
I feel like before this song became, well, it was obviously, it was popular in the 80s, but I felt like then it kind of died out.
Yeah, I agree.
And then when I started coming to Braves games here in like 2000, it seemed like the Braves were like the first team to really start playing it almost every time I went down.
Yeah, and I don't know if that's a coincidence, just that's all we know, so we think that that's like that they...
It may not be, right? It may have been other places, but... So, obviously, you've heard it at the Braves Stadium. It's played in minor league stadiums. It's played at high school fields, even little league fields. Like, it's all...
No way, really?
I literally got sick of hearing it because I, you know, I would hear it almost every game that I coached travel ball. And I, you know, you'd play, you know, I'd coached high school, which was 30-something games a season, and then go immediately into travel ball, which is 50 or 60 games a season. I got so sick of hearing this song. But now that I've broken away, I like the song again because I don't hear it every day, five times a day.
Yeah.
But much like Talking Baseball, this both those songs kind of bring back feelings and nostalgia, don't they?
Yes. Oh, yeah.
So, I have a question for you. I think, speaking of music, so I talked about 1985 being my favorite year. 1987 was another year that the Cardinals went to the World Series. But I remember in 1985, the song The Heat Is On was a popular song because of... Beverly Hills Cop. It's a popular song because of Beverly Hills Cop. And then 1987, Shakedown by Bob Seger was also a number one song because of Beverly Hills Cop 2. But I specifically remember them playing those songs on the St. Louis radio stations and inputting Cardinal highlights during the parts where there were no lyrics. So when it was just music, they would put Cardinal highlights. And I don't know why they did that. I don't know if they did that anywhere else. I would assume that they did it in other cities.
Did you ask your brothers to back you up on this?
I can ask my brothers to back me up on that.
Okay, that's absolutely... Because that just feels really random to
me. Had both of them, you know how you'd sit at the radio and you'd hit record?
Oh, yeah.
I had both of them on cassette tape at some point during the 80s.
So maybe it is
This isn't some vague...
Okay.
Fever dream memory. Like, this is real. I just wonder if other people, A, remember it, and B, if it happened in other cities. So if you're out there and you're listening and you remember this, shoot us a tweet or an email or a Facebook or an Instagram message or whatever. But you don't remember
that. I don't.
You didn't hear that. Didn't hear that. All right. Well, music wasn't the only medium that discussed baseball in the 1980s, was it?
No.
What else did we have?
TV.
Television.
Television. Well, and then also movies, but we're going to get to that momentarily.
All right. So TV, we had mentioned earlier in an earlier episode when we talked about, I think, what we did on a weekend. I had mentioned the Baseball Bunch.
Yeah.
So why don't you go ahead and play that opening for that.
For you, you got a hunch, you'll love the Baseball Bunch.
like, was this on like a PBS? Like, I feel like this was a like a kids thing.
It was a kids thing, but it was on NBC on Saturday mornings or maybe Saturday about noon.
Okay, so after cartoons.
After cartoons were over, they'd play the Baseball Bunch, Johnny Bench, the San Diego Chicken, Tommy Lasorda, even Pete Rose might be on there sometimes.
Was it syndicated?
Yes.
So it wasn't local to you?
No.
Okay.
It was not local to me.
Okay.
No, they did it out in California, I'm pretty sure, because it was always sunny and nice. And that, but, you know, we talked about that before. You know, I was better than all those kids, no doubt in my mind.
Oh, I have no doubt you were.
But, so, we've already discussed that in the past episodes, so we're really not going to get into it. But then, of course, there was This Week in Baseball, which we talked about before, too, which we loved with Mel Allen. And then we also had commercials, and I believe that you remember something about a commercial that had to do with baseball.
The Big League Chew commercials, I remember those. Those really stick out to me. They were undoubtedly put on by tobacco companies trying to get 10-year-olds interested in tobacco.
You're in the big leagues when you make a perfect slide. You're in the big leagues when you keep the team alive. You're in the big leagues when you block a shot or two. You're in the big leagues when you're in the big league chew.
This is something that anybody born after, 1990 can't even begin to relate to this.
I don't think so. I mean, I know they still have Big League Chew. I know that, you know, that kids would still get it at ballparks, you know, when in Little League or whatever, when I came down here. But I don't think that they really ran the commercials or anything like that. And it wasn't like you're putting a big wad of tobacco in your jaw like you were, like they were showing in the 80s, right? I mean, that's right, clearly that's what that commercial was about.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, chew. It's chew.
Yes, it's chew.
Only
it's bubble gum instead of tobacco.
Exactly.
But clearly they're trying to get kids hooked on tobacco.
And that's not, we didn't call it chew in the South.
You called it chaw.
Yes.
I know.
So I'm afraid if I share this story, like once I've shared it, I can't take it back and I don't want people to look at me differently.
What's that story?
But I also feel like I may have talked about it enough that, like, I'm at the point I have to share the story whether I want to or not. So when I was probably 7 or 8, you know, my papaw was the bee's knees, and he always had a chaw. Always.
Right.
Like, to the point that he had a couple of like stretch marks on the side of his face because he always had that big old bulge right there in his bottom, you know, gum. Well, I thought Papaw hung the moon. I wanted to be just like Papaw. So anytime we had like mac and cheese for dinner, I would take a big scoop of the mac and cheese and I would stuff it down in my between my gum and my lower lip because I wanted to be like Papaw.
Now that sounds more like dipping tobacco rather than chewing tobacco like the pouchy red man.
Well, little lens there, it was all the same to me.
Okay.
Right, like
yeah.
I got you. I would just put it like, you know, right here at the base of what is that? Under my like canine tooth. But anyways, and I would keep it there.
What?
For as long as, like, I would go outside and play with it still, like, just right down there.
You know what I got to say about that?
Oh, that was the grossest thing I've ever heard in my life.
I would go out and play. I'd spit every once in a while. My cheese spit.
You should have used the Big League Chew.
Well, I mean, we were poor. I did the best I could.
Oh, my goodness.
Oh, no going back.
At least it wasn't real tobacco.
It was not real tobacco. I've never had a real chaw.
All right. So what were some other cool things about baseball in the 1980s? I got a couple.
Okay.
What about a commissioner that did not try to ruin the game like we have today?
Okay.
Stolen bases without pickoff limits, giant bases, and runners wearing big giant oven mitts on their hands.
Yep.
2-hour games without a pitch clock.
Yep.
World Series games during the day.
That never happens now.
No, I think it's not. I think 1985 was actually the first year where they had, it was the first all-night World Series, like total World Series. But then I remember back in 87 when the Cardinals played the Twins. Shout out to my buddies up in Minnesota. I'm quite certain that you guys cheated to win that World Series, but I'll let it go. I know they had at least one day game. In that World Series. So
yeah.
I don't know when they started like all night and they haven't gone back to day, but
yeah.
That was always cool. Always cool getting a day World Series game.
Do you know what I remember?
What you got?
The bullpen carts with the big giant hat on them.
Yes.
They would bring like the relief pitcher out in a bullpen cart.
Yes, they need to bring those back.
You know what else I remember? The baby blue road uniforms.
Yes.
You remember those?
Those things.
So I know the Braves had them.
The Braves had them. The Cardinals had them. Loved the Cardinals. I'm trying to think who else had them.
I think the Phillies did.
Now, the Phillies, I may like the Phillies baby blues better than the Cardinals. I don't know. It's a toss-up.
But you know I have to go with the Braves.
Well, of course you do. The Brewers had sweet baby blue uniforms too. I may like those the best.
I never paid attention to the American League.
No.
So
I mean, I watched all baseball.
I can't give any feedback there.
But yeah, those were pretty cool.
Well,
let's go back to the bullpen carts. Like, why they need to bring those back, right? Like,
I know they were interesting.
Who hates those things?
No, but who could hate them?
Plus, you always had some crazy guy in a stadium that worked there that would probably go too fast and have the potential of tipping the car over.
Oh, tipping right. it over.
Yeah, tipping it over.
Was it top heavy, you think?
I think that big giant hat was probably weighing it down.
So, well, I know we've talked about songs, commercials,
TV.
Let's get on to the most important thing that we're
Which
here
is
to talk about.
What?
Baseball movies.
Yes.
They were a big part of the landscape during the 1980s. When was the last time a good baseball movie was made?
Okay, 2012?
Which was what?
42.
Jackie Robinson.
Yes.
Right. But, you know, they don't make them anymore. I feel like, don't you think now all they make are, like, action superhero movies?
Yes, they've ruined the movies. But, you know, the 90s had some good baseball movies, right? Sandlot, A League of Their Own.
So, when we started talking about that we were going to do this episode, you said that there were, like, five baseball movies that stand out to you
yes.
from the 1980s.
Yes.
So,
you know me, I like to give the movies or the songs that didn't make the list first.
Oh my
right?
gosh, yes, of course.
So, The Naked Gun had a baseball scene in it, and Reggie Jackson in it, and Leslie Nielsen doing a hilarious home plate umpire thing, but that doesn't count. That's not a baseball movie.
Okay.
Brewster's Millions with Richard Pryor and John Candy had some great baseball scenes in it. Richard Pryor's the pitcher, John Candy's the catcher. They're kind of like a semi-pro baseball team. But that movie's really about a guy trying to inherit $300 million or $30 million. Stealing Home was another baseball movie.
Never heard of that.
Well, that's a good thing because it's horrible.
I didn't miss anything?
You didn't miss anything. And here's one, The Slugger's Wife.
What is that?
That's about a baseball player who plays for the Braves.
Oh.
And he marries, I want to say, Rebecca De Mornay. And it's just about their life, but that's horrible, too. Those were both failures. So, in my mind, there's five of them. Do you want to hear the five up front, or do you just want to go one by one?
I just want to go one by one. Is this in order?
This is in order as far as chronologically, when it was released. So, you can guess our first movie we've already talked about when we did 1984 movies, and that is The Natural.
So, it's directed by Barry Levinson. It stars Robert Redford, Robert Duvall, Glenn Close, Kim Basinger, Wilford Brimley, and Barbara Hershey. Who else? The dad from The Christmas Story.
Yeah.
He was uncredited.
Darren McGavin.
Thank you. He was uncredited in this movie, but I feel like I should mention him. So, It had a budget of $28 million and had a box office earning of $48 million. So that's not half bad.
I'm guessing that majority of that $28 million budget probably went to star salary, don't you think?
I would think so. It's amazing to me the wonderful reviews that this movie got.
Yeah.
So Variety called it an, quote, impeccably made fable about success and failure in America, unquote.
Ooh.
ESPN's Page Two selected it as the sixth best sports movie of all time.
Way too low.
James Berardinelli praised The Natural as, quote, arguably the best baseball movie ever made. Y'all, I don't know about that. Okay, now this is the one. Oh, Gary Busey's in the house.
Of course.
Hey, buddy. He's obviously got something to say about The Natural. So this is the one I take issue with this. Sports writer Bill Simmons has argued any best sports movies list that doesn't feature either Hoosiers or The Natural as the number one pick shouldn't even count.
Sports writer Bill Simmons is 100% correct.
I almost always agree with Bill Simmons. I feel like he is able to put into words and express things that I want to express, but I'm just not able to. I'm a little upset.
You know what? I'm going to show you Hoosiers next, and you're going to hate it just as much as you hated The Natural.
So, won lots of awards. It was nominated. Well, I shouldn't say it won. It was nominated for lots of awards. 4 Academy Awards, Supporting Actress for Glenn Close, Cinematography, Art Direction, and Music. Randy Newman did the music for The Natural.
Yes, he did the score, yes.
So Kim Basinger received a Golden Globe nomination for Best Supporting Actress. So can you just sum up this movie for me in just like, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 lines?
Sure. I can do that. Let's see, The Natural. Teenage boy and dad bond over baseball before dad dies of a heart attack, and boy carves a bat out of a tree struck by lightning.
The dad died under that tree.
He died under that tree, yes. Mm-hmm. Let's see, next. Teenager heads for a tryout with the Cubs, strikes out the Major League Baseball's best hitter at a carnival, and gets gut shot by a crazy woman who then kills herself.
When he says gut shot, he means literally.
Literally gut shot with a gun.
Yes. Yes.
16 years later, the teenager, who is an old man, Roy Hobbs, appears out of nowhere and gets signed by the New York Knights, a fledgling team whose beloved but crusty manager eats Quaker oats because he's got the diabetes.
Oh, why did Wilford Brimley, he just looked different. When we were watching this
movie, you couldn't
believe
that it was Wilford Brimley.
I just kept saying, that sounds like him, but I don't think that's him.
It was him.
That's him, folks.
Okay, so this old man becomes Ted Williams, combined with any roided up 1990s slugger, even though the diabetes fella refused to play him because he's old and crusty.
Okay, so old man, he is, okay, I agree with he is Ted Williams, but he's not like a roided up 90s slugger because he wasn't like buffed up. He was not.
Right, but he hit home runs at a rate that the roided up 90s sluggers did.
He did.
Okay. Roy Hobbs becomes the greatest hitter of all time and leads the New York Knights to the pennant and keeps Billy Madison's dad from being able to buy out the Quaker Oats guy from the team. So those are my words in 5 minutes. Just a little postscript there. The team gets a sponsorship from both Quaker Oats and Madison Hotels where their mascot changes from a knight to a penguin.
Okay, he's joking. Joking. So back in college, I didn't do well in high school, so I had to start my college career at a junior college to try to get myself back on track. But I thought, because I was always looking for the easy way out, I thought, okay, it's going to be a super easy class. I'm going to take, I'm trying to think of what the official title of the class, but like
Film Appreciation?
Yes, I think that was it. So I'm going to take this class. This was way back, like, I don't know, maybe like 99, and it was online, quote unquote, online. So I'm like, heck yeah. I don't have to go to class and I just have to watch movies. Y'all, I ended up with a C in the class. I didn't understand any of the movies we watched. Like, I just didn't get it. Like, what in the world? Okay, and these were supposed to be, like, the greats. This is exactly how I felt when I watched The Natural. Like, I was sitting there, and I'm like, I just don't get it. I feel like I'm in some kind of weird dream state. So that's why I'm thinking this probably is one of the all-time greats. Because I didn't get it, and I felt weird watching it.
Okay, so let's go back to 1984. There hadn't been a lot of baseball movies done prior to 1984, and none of them were any good, with the exception maybe of Pride of the Yankees, about Lou Gehrig's life, right, starring Gary Cooper. There had been some other baseball movies. There was a baseball movie where Arnold, from Different Strokes, was the son of Benson. And Benson, I think, had been the manager of the Padres, and he got sick or something. And so Arnold took over, and he became the manager of the Padres.
Arnold as in, like, little?
Arnold as in, yes, as in Gary Coleman.
Little Arnold.
It was ridiculous.
Okay.
A precursor to Little Big League, where the kid would then manage the Twins in the 90s.
Disturbing. Okay. I mean, not disturbing. That's offensive. That sounds offensive. It sounds unusual.
It's ridiculous is what it is. So The Natural, at that time, was definitely the best baseball movie that ever came out. We can have an argument over movies that have followed that since then, whether or not they're better. The Natural isn't my favorite, but to me, it's still the best. So the nostalgia factor and the way that the sports writers used to just go on and on about the mythology of baseball and how great baseball was and all that stuff. And like we heard with the James Earl Jones quote earlier when we started the podcast, that's what this movie's really about.
So I thought...
Bigger than life.
So I've seen this movie twice. Well, I've seen this movie 1.5 times. The first time, it lost me when he was shot. Like, I don't know if you remember, but I was literally like, yeah, I'm done.
No, you literally fell asleep.
Well, yeah, I was done. So that's as far as I got. The second time I watched it, I just kept thinking, okay, this is he died, and this is like some weird dream state. Or I was like, he was reincarnated. And that's why 16 years passed. Like, we had to wait for him to die and be born again and grow up. Like, I just kept, like, going, like, what in the world is going on here?
No, he was a 35-year-old man. It took him a long time to recover. You saw at the end.
Who takes 16 years to recover?
It was 1923. Do you think they, you know what kind of surgery they had then? Let me dig my dirty fingers into the hole in your stomach and try to pull out the silver bullet that's inside
you. Well, and I don't understand at some point, you know, when he has to go back in and they do some kind of a revision surgery and the doctor's like, your gut could explode in any moment.
Yeah, I didn't get that
part. I was
like,
I don't understand that.
I think that was a little bit over the top, like most of the rest of the movie.
So then when he's at that final at bat,
mm-hmm.
and he starts like...
Spoiler alert.
I mean, yeah. And he starts bleeding through his shirt. So I think he's dying.
No. So do you remember when Curt Schilling had the blood on his sock in the World Series back in 2007 or whatever it was?
No.
So Curt Schilling had had surgery on his ankle, and then all of a sudden blood starts steeping through his sock as he's pitching.
Ugh.
And he pitches a gym, and they start comparing him to the movie The Natural because, you know, the camera's really focused on that. So anyway, this was longer than I expected to talk about this movie because we had previously talked about it, but I think we covered it a little bit more than we did last time.
Sorry.
That's all right. So let's get to the best quote. In my opinion, there's two. One is Roy Hobbs talking about, and then when I walked down the street, people would have looked out and they would have said, there goes Roy Hobbs, the best there ever was in this game. And then my other favorite one is at the end of the movie when he breaks his bat and the little bat boy's out there looking at him and picks up his bat.
Yeah, he was a cutie.
Says, pick me out a winner, Bobby. Of course, yeah. Bobby goes and gets him the bat that he had made personally. Yeah.
I love that. And I love the little bat boy. I have one more question for you. I know we have to move on. Why does Roy not want to tell people he was shot and he took almost 2 decades to recover?
I don't know. He's a private, simple farm boy from Nebraska.
It just would have, I feel like it would have cut out a lot of like confusion and a lot of the issues and a lot of the turmoil if he would have just like been up front.
I think maybe there was some controversy there. And maybe he spent part of his 16 years in prison. Like after recovering from his thing, because maybe they thought he had something to do with it. Oh,
okay. Okay. She jumped out a window, right?
She did.
Yeah, so I guess they could have been like, yeah, you pushed her?
After you got shot.
After you got shot and died?
I would still think that would be self-defense, yeah, but who knows?
I don't know. Let's move on.
Oh, I'm move exhausted. On. All right, so we're going to fast forward 4 years to 1988 and go to what many of my baseball friends thought was their favorite baseball movie.
Man, this is a good movie.
Bull Durham, which was released in 1988. So funny that you said it's a good movie because the whole time we watched it, you just kept talking about how horrible it was.
I know. I had to like...
How horrible it was. This movie's really, horrible.
I had to really think about it.
Last night when we went to bed, I was convinced that you liked The Natural better than Bull Durham.
No. I think Kevin Costner in Bull Durham, if he actually had an income, he would be the perfect man. The only thing he lacked in that movie was an income.
Well, he's a minor league baseball player.
Guess they don't get paid a lot. I guess you can't have it all, can you?
You can't have it all. Why don't you give him the deets?
Okay. It was written and directed by Ron Shelton. As I mentioned, it stars Kevin Costner, Susan Sarandon, and Tim Robbins.
So I've got some TWIB notes for you this week in baseball. Yeah, this week in baseball notes. You know, they'd do Bill Allen would do the TWIB notes in the middle of the thing.
Okay, give them to me.
So this film is partly based on Ron Shelton's minor league baseball playing experience. He was actually a minor league baseball player. And to me, this has the best use of baseball lingo from any of the baseball movies.
Okay.
So it's just, it really is.
It was gritty.
At least in the 80s, yeah. It's how baseball players talk.
It was gritty.
On the field.
And it felt authentic to me.
All right. So there you go. So there's my TWIB notes. You go back to the
beats. I have three things just to sum up each of these actors and their characters.
Okay.
I've already told you Kevin Costner was perfect.
Yes.
Susan Sarandon, chicken legs.
Chicken legs.
Tim Robbins, odd looking, but that poofy hair he had through all of the movie did not help his oddity.
No, I think that was on purpose.
But. Okay. They made the movie at a $9 million budget. Listen to this. It had a box office earning of $50.9 million.
It was a hit.
Everybody thought Kevin Costner was the perfect man. In David Anson's review for Newsweek, he wrote that the film works equally as a love story, a baseball fable, and a comedy while ignoring the cliches of each genre. That sums it up really well. It gets a 97% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
Not too many movies get a higher rating than that.
No. It was nominated for one Academy Award, which was Best Original Screenplay by Ron Shelton.
Right.
Susan Sarandon received a Golden Globe nomination for Best Actress.
For her chicken legs?
For her chicken legs. I mean, she could work them chicken legs. Right. So can you sum this movie up for me?
Want me to do five lines again?
Yep, do it.
All right. Here we go. Ebby Nuke Lelouch is the prize-pitching prospect with the million-dollar arm and five-cent head, starting out his professional career in A-ball with the Durham Bulls. 12-year veteran and career minor leaguer Crash Davis is a catcher with years of wisdom who is sent down to A-ball to be Nuke's meaner and crankier version of Mr. Miyagi.
Yeah.
Annie, played by Susan Sarandon, is a baseball groupie who every year chooses a player to be her boyfriend, and this year she has her eyes on both Nuke and Crash. Crash turns out to be the veteran leader that all of the kids need, but him and Nuke continue to clash because Crash believes Nuke wastes his talent, while Crash never had that talent. Nuke gets called up to the majors while Crash gets released from the team, eventually breaking the minor league home run record with another team before retiring and coming back to Durham to live happily ever after with Annie.
I love that it ended that way. I hate it when a movie ends either with like a cliffhanger or it ends like with a, you know, a sad ending and we don't get that satisfaction that we want. I hate that because then I can't let it go and forget about it.
The Natural ended with a happy ending. He crushed the home run. Yes. Diabetes guy gets his team yes. back and he goes back to Nebraska yeah. and farm with his son yeah. that he never knew he had, teaching him how to play baseball.
I know. So after this podcast, I'll never have to think about it again. And I feel the same about Bull Durham because he went back. He settled down with Annie. They lived happily ever after. I can put it to bed and never think about it again. And that's what I like about a good movie.
All right. Best quote. I've got two of them again. Crash Davis. Both of them. Kevin Costner, right? You know what the difference between hitting 250 and 300 is? It's 25 hits. 25 hits and 500 at-bats is 50 points, okay? There's 6 months in a season. That's about 25 weeks. That means if you get just one extra flare a week, just one, a gork, a ground ball with eyes, you get a dying quail, just one more dying quail a week, and you're in Yankee Stadium.
I like that.
And then possibly my favorite quote, because my American Legion baseball coach would do this. If you were leading off an inning and you were in the on-deck circle swinging, he'd be walking towards either first base or third base. He would stop and he'd go, "Get a hit, Crash." And you'd have to look at him and go, "Shut up."
I like that. I like that. It's a good movie.
So funny how you've done a complete 180 on that. Because yeah. I thought you were going to get on here and just rip it.
So Tim Robbins just creeps me out.
Well, we're going to talk a little. So Tim Robbins had a horrible pitching motion. He clearly is not athletic.
Yeah, and he does a weird, like, he does a weird thing with his head as he's winding up for the pitch. And I even asked you, like, why is he doing that? But you thought it might have something to do with her telling him in the movie
to be more like Fernando Valenzuela.
To, like, breathe through his eyes or yes. something like that. That he may, so that might have been on purpose.
Yes, it may have been.
But it was just very distracting.
Very. Very. But I will say that Kevin Costner was a real baseball player.
Yeah.
He switch hits in this movie. He catches in this movie. He's got a great swing, right? Kevin Costner was a real baseball player.
What about, sure. back up just a second, what about Robert Redford?
Robert Redford was also an American Legion baseball player. He also had a good swing.
Really?
I think Kevin Costner probably had a better swing, but Robert Redford had been a baseball player too, for sure.
Okay.
But you have to realize Robert Redford was like 45 or 46 when that movie was made. Like, he was old. He's older than you.
Well, I mean, one foot in the grave. He did look old.
No, I mean, that's Hollywood.
Yeah. I look old. I'm not Hollywood.
All right, moving on to our next movie. And this might be my favorite movie of the bunch. Also released in 1988. This movie is Eight Men Out. And it is about the 1919 Chicago White Sox throwing the World Series.
This is the only movie of the five movies that we are talking about that I actually saw around the time of their release.
Really?
Now, it was 1990 maybe, okay. when I saw mm-hmm. it, but rented it at Blockbuster.
Okay. There you go.
Yeah.
That's an 80s thing.
I mean, I don't know why, but we did.
All right. Why don't you give us the deets about 8 minutes?
Okay. Written and directed by John Sayles.
Lots of stars.
Lots of stars. Get ready, y'all. John Cusack, John Mahoney, my boy D.B. Sweeney, Michael Rooker, Charlie Sheen, David Stratham, Clifton James, Michael Lerner, and Christopher Lloyd.
Yes.
Now, Christopher Lloyd, as in Doc?
As in Doc, yes. And, okay. And John Mahoney is in Frasier's dad.
Well, that's what I thought. But I was like, maybe there's another John Mahoney.
Nope.
Okay.
Nope.
Does he have his accent in Eight Men Out? Because he's British.
No, he does not.
Okay.
Not too many British fellas playing baseball or managing baseball in the 19-teens and 20s.
Just had to ask. Okay. So it's based on a true story of how the 1919 White Sox conspired with gamblers to throw the World Series.
Correct.
So it was made with a $6.1 million budget and didn't do so well. Mm-mm. It had a box office earning of $5.7 million.
That's a travesty. Yikes. This is a good movie.
What happened?
So I think that this movie is really more for the baseball historian than it is for just the average moviegoer, right? The average moviegoer isn't going to care about the 1919 White Sox throwing the World Series. Only true baseball fans are going to do that. You know what they named them after this? They actually named them the Black Sox.
Yes.
So I got a couple of TWIB notes for you. John Sayles, the guy who wrote and directed the movie, said that he hired John Cusack and Charlie Sheen not because they were rising stars, but because of their baseball playing ability. Charlie Sheen said his reasons for taking the role were this: I'm not in this for cash or my career or my performance. I wanted to take part in this film because I love baseball.
Oh, wow.
That's another, you know, Charlie Sheen's another good baseball player. Charlie Sheen, Robert Redford, Kevin Costner, they were all good baseball players.
In real life.
Yeah. I don't know how good they were in real life.
They weren't faking what they were doing.
They weren't faking what they were doing. They were actually good baseball players. You know, it would have been neat if they could have hired, if one of these movies would have had Kurt Russell in it, because Kurt Russell actually did play minor league baseball.
Oh, he did?
He did. For his dad up in Oregon.
So, Gene Siskel agrees with you. He says, quote, Eight Men Out is fascinating if you're a baseball nut. The portrayal of the recruiting of the ball players and the tight-fisted rule of Comiskey is fascinating. Thumbs up, unquote. End quote. Stop quoting. it gets an 87% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
So obviously it's a good movie, right? 87%. They don't give 87% to bad movies. Those are really good movies. So I just think it just missed out on the box office.
And it got no awards.
It wasn't
nominated, didn't win.
It wins my award as most realistic baseball movie ever.
Okay, there you go.
So it's got an award.
So sum it up for me.
All right. Best team of all time, up to that point, plays for cheap owner who doesn't pay players what they're worth and goes cheap on everything, including not paying out bonuses for winning the pennant. Some players known for being unhappy about the owner's stinginess are approached by gamblers to throw the World Series against the inferior Cincinnati Red Stockings. They were the Red Stockings back then, not the Reds. Eight players hold a meeting conspiring to throw the series for money. Lloyd Dobler and Shoeless Joe Jackson are two of the eight, but never agree to throw games and end up being the two best players for the White Sox in the World Series. An investigation is launched, and while the eight players are found not guilty in court, the newly appointed commissioner of baseball, Kennesaw Mountain Landis, bans all eight from baseball for life. And as a result, the 1919 White Sox are forever known as the Black Sox. Say it ain't so, Joe.
So was Shoeless Joe Jackson part of the eight?
He was part of the eight that was in on the meeting, but he did not agree to it. And he actually ended up, this is an argument that Kevin Costner has in Field of Dreams. Shoeless Joe actually ended up hitting like 360 or something in the World Series. Like he did not.
He did not throw games. So we know he did not throw
it. He did not throw games, but Kennesaw Mountain Landis decided to ban him from baseball for life anyway.
He did ban Shoeless Joe Jackson.
Shoeless Joe Jackson is not in the Hall of Fame. He's one of the greatest hitters of all time. Or at least he was, you know, in the 1920s.
Just for attending. Mm-hmm. Man, that's pretty rough.
It's harsh, yeah. I mean, everybody complains about Pete Rose not being in the Hall of Fame, but he actually did bet on baseball.
Yeah.
And he knew better because there are signs in every major league clubhouse saying, do not bet on baseball. It is a life offense. You will be banished for life.
We've got somebody now. There's a player now betting that got caught betting.
Yeah, we'll see how that turns out.
So it's something that, like, apparently players haven't learned.
Right.
You know, from history. It keeps repeating itself. Okay, so I'm sorry. I have a couple of more questions.
Yes, go.
So what goes on and what happens to these guys? Like, baseball is probably all they know. What do they do? What does Shoeless Joe do?
Shoeless Joe goes and assumes another identity and starts playing in, like, independent leagues and stuff like that. Yeah. That's how the movie ends, is Buck Weaver, played by John Cusack, goes and sees Shoeless Joe playing in, like, a, you know, an independent league or a semi-pro league or something like that. And some guy recognizes him and says, "That looks like Shoeless Joe Jackson. That can't be him." And they start talking, you know, some kids know who it is, some don't. And they ask Buck Weaver, who they don't realize he's Buck Weaver. He's like, "Yeah, I saw him play." And they were like, "What was he like?" And he was like, "He was the best."
Did any of the other players that were banned have the talent / potential that Shoeless Joe had?
No, they did not. Eddie Seacott, or as John Cusack calls him in the movie, Eddie Seacotti, which cracks me up. He was a fantastic pitcher. He may have been a Hall of Fame pitcher. He actually won 29 games that year. And one of the reasons why he conspired to throw the World Series is because he was to get a $10,000 bonus if he won 30 games that year. And the owner had the manager sit him for like 3 or 4 weeks in like August when he was at like 25, 26 wins. And so he only got to 29 because he was held out of 4 or 6 starts or something that. Because the owner didn't want to pay him his $10,000 bonus. And so that hacked him off. And so he, you know, he decided to throw the World Series.
Yikes.
All right. So best quote of the movie. I love this quote from Buck Weaver. Because as a baseball player, and anybody that's listening out there that played baseball will know this feeling. He says, "You get out there and the stands are full and everybody's cheering. It's like everybody in the world comes to see you. And inside of that, there's the players. They're yakking it up. The pitcher throws and you look for that pill. Suddenly there's nothing else in the ballpark but you and it. Sometimes when you feel right, there's a groove there and the bat just eases into it and meets the ball. When the bat meets the ball, and you feel that ball just give, you know it's going to go a long way. Damn if you didn't feel like you were going to live forever."
That's a good one. That's a real good one.
And then there was also a very, very funny quote in there that always cracked me up. The Reds come to the World Series. Back then, you know, there were only 8 teams in each league, right? And there was obviously no TV, right? There was hardly radio. National League players didn't see American League players play and vice versa. You just heard about it. You read about it in the paper, whatever. So one Cincinnati Reds player says to the other guy, "These guys don't look so tough." And the second guy says, "Yeah, that's what Custer said when the Indians took the field."
Oh. That makes me sad. I'm a little sad.
Yeah. Yeah, if you go look up Shoeless Joe's stats, I think he's like a career like 356 hitter or something wacky, like just an amazing ball player.
So I want to circle back around to Shoeless Joe once we get into Field of Dreams.
Okay.
And I'll just, like, you know, put a pin in it for now. But I try to tell Emmy all the time, like, if you feel like you've been wronged, if somebody has hurt you, I also try to tell myself this, like, don't retaliate.
Right.
In fact, do your best to not even dwell on it. Just move on.
Let it go.
Let it go. And most of the time, you know, it'll all work itself out. And so that's unfortunate that that feller couldn't do that.
Yeah, it was tough.
What feller?
Shoeless Joe Jackson?
No, the one that he got mad.
Oh, Eddie Seacott.
Yeah. Thank you. Okay.
All right.
Life lesson.
Next movie, released a year later in 1989, and absolutely the funniest baseball movie of all time, is Major League.
Oh, my goodness. Totally opposite from the other movies we've been talking about.
Yes.
So, it was written and directed by David S. Ward. He's been nominated for 2 Oscars for his screenplays, The Sting and Sleepless in Seattle.
Oh, wow.
And he won for The Sting. Okay.
Sting also a Robert Redford movie.
That's right. You're right. Okay, so it stars Tom Berenger, Charlie Sheen, Wesley Snipes, Corbin Burnson, Rene Russo, and Bob Uecker.
Oh, love Bob Uecker.
They made the movie on an $11 million budget, had a box office earning of, drumroll, $75 million. Woo-hoo-hoo-hoo-hoo. Gets an 83% rating on Rotten Tomatoes.
So that's interesting that it gets an 83% rating and it had such a great big box office. And yeah. 8 Men Out is actually higher rated on Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes.
And was a bomb.
Yes,
was a flop.
I don't understand it. Was a flop. Right? I don't understand it.
All right, some TWIB notes for you on the movie. Pedro Serrano, I bet you didn't know that. I bet you didn't recognize this when you saw this movie. He's actually played by Dennis Haysbert, the Allstate guy.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to have to go back and do like a side-by-side of that.
I knew you were going to say that. And then another TWIB note, 1982 Cy Young Award winner Pete Vukovich is evil Yankees first baseman Clue Haywood. He leads the league in most offensive categories, including nose hairs.
Is that what Bob Uecker says?
Yes, yes. Willie Mueller, a former pitcher for the Milwaukee Brewers, plays Duke Simpson, the evil Yankee reliever who isn't afraid to hit batters. He once threw at his kid in a father-son game. Neil Flynn from Scrub plays a fan. And the pitcher Eddie Harris, who uses Vaseline, snot, and other substances to doctor the ball, is based on Hall of Famer Gaylord Perry. Interestingly enough, this is the second baseball movie with Charlie Sheen in it, as we just talked about 8 Men Out. And this was filmed at Milwaukee County Stadium rather than Cleveland. Both Mueller and Vukovich played for the Brewers, and Bob Uecker is the longtime Brewers radio voice. So it made sense that they used them since they were filming it in Milwaukee because they could not film it in Cleveland due to football.
Back up for a second, because, I mean, you just flew through that. Neil Flynn, he's from Scrubs.
Yes.
He's the janitor.
He's the janitor. That's correct.
And then he was also the dad in the middle.
In the middle.
Okay.
Yeah. Mike Heck. Yes.
Okay. So this movie won 0 awards, but it should be noted that the opening scene is a song by Randy Newman, who wrote the score for The Natural.
You can see a lot of coinciding with all these baseball movies,
and
right?
He was everywhere back then. So sum this up for me in 5 lines.
All right. Former Las Vegas showgirl inherits the Cleveland Indians baseball team from her deceased husband and decides she'd rather live in Miami than in Cleveland. She plots to exploit an escape clause in her contract with the city of Cleveland by fielding the worst team ever in hopes that attendance drops and she can get out of the contract. She invites has-beens and never-will-bes to spring training to fill out what she hopes will be a horrible roster. Ragtag group of characters fall under the leadership of Lou Brown, Goodyear tire salesman, who knows how to handle the egos and personalities of the bunch of losers.
I loved him.
Rallying around their disdain for their owner, the team puts together an incredible second half of the season to win their division in a 1-game playoff against the hated Yankees and keep the team in the city of Cleveland. How's that for?
I mean, you did really well. You summed it up really well. So,
what did you think about the movie?
You know what? I like it. It's a good, like, I don't have to think too hard about it movie. Right. And I love the quirkiness of each of the baseball players. You know, especially I like Charlie Sheen and
Veghead.
Veghead, is that his name? Yeah. And then Willie Mays Hayes cracked me up.
Yes.
So,
say hey.
And I love the Lou Brown. I thought he was a hoot.
Yeah, Lou Brown's fantastic. Great manager.
So
I'd hire Lou Brown to be my manager.
It was a good movie. I've got no like deep thoughts about it, but I'd watch it again.
What'd you think about Bob Uecker?
You know how much I love Bob Uecker.
Yes. Was he not hilarious? Was his lines announcing the game not hilarious?
He was hilarious, but was that not just totally ad-libbed?
Most of it, yeah.
Right? He just did his thing.
He did. I think they just said, here, Bob, go do your thing. You know, this is the team. This is the script. You know, we're going to show some baseball scenes. You do your thing.
And I've probably said this before, but if you've never listened to his Hall of Fame induction speech, pause the episode right now and go listen.
It's worth it, isn't it?
I love it.
In case you haven't noticed, and judging by the attendance, you haven't. The Indians are on a little bit of a streak here. So anything by Bob Uecker is the quote of the movie. But Lou Brown, he was fantastic too. You talked about how much you loved him. I loved it when they're in spring training and he's talking to Rick Vaughn, who's played by Charlie Sheen, who's just released from jail, and he cuts his sleeves off his jersey doing spring training. And he says, "They say you're a pitcher, but you sure ain't much of a dresser. We wear caps and sleeves at this level, son."
Yes. I love Charlie Sheen's character and the weird little cutouts he's got in his hairline, like really weird, and the fact that he, you know, cut the sleeves out of his jersey. And then his glasses just cracked me up.
You know what I think? I think he had just gotten out of prison after he had made out with Ferris's sister when they were waiting in the...
Yes, that's it.
When they're waiting in the police station.
You've got it figured out. Yes, that's exactly what happened.
So he then went to play for the California Penal League before making it to the majors.
Yep.
What'd you think about... So we talked about Charlie Sheen, Kevin Costner, and old man being good baseball players.
I'm afraid about who you're going to ask me about right now. Are you going to ask me about Corbin Burnson?
No. No, Corbin Burnson, yeah, no. So, Pete Vukovich, who was, like I said, he won the Cy Young in 1982 for the Milwaukee Brewers. He's actually the first baseman. He's the best baseball player in any of these movies, because he's so young, but he wasn't playing a pitcher, right? He was playing the first baseman, a hitter, but clearly Pete could hit too. Just tell by his swing, just hitting bombs off of wild thing, Rick Vaughn. So,
who was the star of this movie?
That's a good question. It's Tom Berenger.
Yeah,
I think it's Tom Berenger. Not the best baseball player. The best baseball player was, well, Pete Vukovich, but then Charlie Sheen.
Yeah, but I think Tom Berenger was the star because he was the only one that we got to see, like, past the baseball field.
We got to see Corbin Burnson a little bit.
Yeah, but he was a doofus. So we got to see past the baseball field, and, you know, we kind of got invested, and we wanted to see him work things out with the love of his life. So
he goes back to Rene Russo when he first meets her and he's talking to her or whatever. And after that scene, I looked at you and I said, "Do you think they're going to end up together?" And you were like, "Oh yeah."
Is he not old enough to be her dad?
Probably.
I mean, I don't know, but I feel like probably. And then why? Who thought Corbin Burnson was a good... Because he plays a good jerk?
Yes, he does. Corbin Burnson plays a good jerk.
I don't think he could pretend to play baseball if his life depended on it. He plays a good jerk
and he's a pretty boy.
Yeah.
You know what? You just hit me with something, though, talking about Tom Berenger. Tom Berenger and Charlie Sheen were also in a movie 3 years prior to this. They were in Platoon together.
Tom Berenger was in Platoon?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Tom Berenger and Charlie Sheen.
Wow.
So you liked this movie?
Yes, it was a good movie. You know, I'd watch it again with you.
I like the Randy Newman opening song about Cleveland.
Yes,
and then of course, you know, the ending with, you know, Wild Thing and all that stuff. So that was, it's an enjoyable movie. It's not my favorite movie, but it's a very enjoyable movie. It was probably my favorite movie in the 80s, just because of the comedy. And because of the feeling it gives you at the end, you know, you're really rooting for the Indians.
So, I have a question for you.
Yes.
Who was the best female love interest?
Rene Russo.
No. Glenn Close from The Natural. Susan Sarandon from Bull Durham. Rene Russo from Major League. And then 8 Men Out didn't have a love interest.
No, but one of the here's what's funny. One of the pitchers that also conspired to throw the World Series, his wife was played by Nancy Travis.
Oh, really?
Yes. She had.
Love her.
She just had a small bit part in it.
And I'm not going to count the wife in Field of Dreams because she was the wife. Like, there was no, like, are they going to...
Right, are they going to get together?
So, those three.
Well, you left out Kim Basinger from The Natural because Robert Redford actually had 2 love interests in The Natural.
Is she not the one that shot him?
No, that was Barbara Hershey.
Help me with what did Kim Basinger do?
Remember, they dated and he started going into a slump. And
oh, she was the bad luck.
Yeah, she was the bad luck.
Oh, gosh. they were using her to try to bring him down.
Yes.
And she kind of went along with it, but then she really had feelings for him, and so she kind of didn't.
That's why she got so mad at the end, because she knew his baseball career wasn't going to last long and he wasn't going to make a lot of money. And they were willing to pay him like a ton of money, which could have set them up for life.
Yeah.
And that's why she got so mad at him at the end.
Okay, so tell me then, which of those?
I believe I already answered. Asked and answered, Your Honor.
Yes.
Rene Russo.
Rene Russo. Okay. She's definitely the classiest.
For sure. For sure.
I'm going to pick Susan Sarandon, but just because I'm obsessed with Susan Sarandon and Kevin Costner. How did Susan Sarandon and Tim Burton end up together?
Not Tim Burton. Susan Sarandon ended up with Danny Elfman, not Tim Burton.
Okay, help me out here.
Tim Robbins.
How did Susan Sarandon and Tim Robbins end up together in real life?
When she was in the same movie with Kevin Costner.
When Susan Sarandon and Kevin Costner had the chemistry of dynamite.
I'm assuming Kevin Costner was already married.
He probably was. I mean, talk about some bad luck.
I feel like you're best friends with Susan Sarandon now. All right. Speaking of Kevin Costner, we got one more Kevin Costner movie to go. I love how all these movies are doubling up. Randy Newman, Charlie Sheen, Kevin Costner. Field of Dreams, released just a few weeks, just 2 weeks after Major League. And I saw Major League in the theater.
Oh, wow, you old.
And that's the only one that I saw in the theater. I actually didn't see Field of Dreams until like 1991.
Whoa. Okay, so Field of Dreams came out April 21st, 1989. Written and directed by Phil Alden Robinson. It stars Kevin Costner, Amy Madigan. Did she ever do anything else?
Yeah, she's been in some stuff.
James Earl Jones.
Yes.
Jim Butler. And Burt Lancaster. There's an inside joke. So they say in the podcasting world,
don't make inside jokes.
Yeah, don't make inside jokes because you lose your audience. So it has been said by some past ladies in Jim's life, not me, long before me, that he might favor Ray Liotta. Luckily for me and Jim and Emmy.
I've aged better than Ray Liotta.
Aged a lot better than poor Ray Liotta. But that's why I said that. Ray Liotta's in this movie. Okay, so the film was made with a $15 million budget, but wow, it had a box office earning of $84.4 million.
Yes.
Yowzer.
All right, before you get on with your stuff, let me jump in with my TWIB notes here. Another baseball movie about Shoeless Joe Jackson. Another baseball movie featuring Kevin Costner. Here's what's funny. Costner was not originally considered because the writer-director, Phil Robinson, thought that he would not want to do another baseball movie coming right off of Bull Durham. So they didn't originally consider him.
Oh, wow.
The role of Ray was first offered to Tom Hanks, who turned it down. Yet he read the script and stated that the film would be this generation's It's a Wonderful Life.
But why did he turn it down then?
I don't know why he turned it down. I guess maybe he thought he wasn't right for it. I think Kevin Costner works in this movie.
Oh, yeah, he does.
Because, you know, he not just builds the field, but he's out there playing catch and throwing batting practice and everything else. So,
yep.
You know, he had to have some baseball ability. I don't know if Tom Hanks has that or not, but we know that Kevin Costner does. All right, here's my TWIB notes. You go on.
So Roger Ebert awarded the film a perfect 4 stars.
Whoa.
Admiring its ambition. This is the kind of movie Frank Capra might have directed and James Stewart might have starred in. A movie about dreams.
Now, what's ironic about that?
I know, right?
Because Frank Capra directed It's a Wonderful Life and Jimmy Stewart starred
in it. Yeah. It got a 97% rating on Rotten Tomatoes. Nominated for 3 Academy Awards, Best Picture, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Score. Gary Busey's back. It did not win any of those awards. Lost to Driving Miss Daisy. On the first two, Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay. And then it lost to The Little Mermaid for Best Score.
I told you, Disney just writes out movie hits, or, you know, song hits all the time. But yeah, winning to Drive Miss Daisy, no.
Yikes.
No, sorry. I think they got to redo that.
Driving Miss Daisy is a good movie, but it's no Field of Dreams.
No, Field of Dreams is it's magical.
Okay, give me, like, sum this movie up for me in 5 lines, if that is even possible.
Okay, I will attempt to do that. Iowa farmer with daddy issues starts hearing voices, and instead of seeing a shrink, he murders his crop and builds a baseball field so perfect that little leagues across America should hire Kevin Costner to build their fields. The voice he was hearing belonged to the ghost of Shoeless Joe Jackson, who, while he was dead, learned how to switch hit and became a right-hander.
That's funny.
Still hearing voices and now having dreams, Ray heads to Boston to kidnap a reclusive writer who eerily sounds like Darth Vader and then takes him to a Red Sox game where a secret message is given to them both. The secret message is to go find a dead doctor in Minnesota who once played in a major league game but never got to bat. The doctor comes back to life as an 18-year-old hitchhiker, goes back to the field with the other ghosts, one of whom is Ray's dad, where reconciliation is found through the two playing catch.
Wow.
How was that,
man,
for 5 lines?
That's a good job. Okay, so give me, what are the best quotes of the movie? If you can give me just a couple.
Okay, so obviously the most famous quote is, if you build it, he will come. The voice, what, everybody just assumed that the voice was talking about Shoeless Joe Jackson. But it wasn't.
No, it was talking about
his
Ray's dad.
Yes, because his dad was a huge Shoeless Joe Jackson fan. They got into a huge fight about something, and then Ray told his dad that Shoeless Joe Jackson was a cheater who deserved to be banned from baseball, and then never talked to him again, and then his dad died. So that's why I said at the beginning he had daddy issues. But the best quote to live life by came from Dr. Archibald Moonlight Graham when he was old. The old man, played by Burt Lancaster, said, you know, we just don't recognize the most significant moments of our lives while they're happening. Back then I thought, well, there'll be other days. I didn't realize that was the only day.
Oh, man, that hurts.
Yes. And then the most sentimental quote, which may or may not seem like the room gets dusty and I have to wipe, you know, the dust tears away from my eyes, is, Dad, want to have a catch?
Oh, man. Okay, so I have a question for you.
Yes.
If I remember correctly, Shoeless Joe is very timid to come out on the field. Ghost Shoeless Joe.
So this is the only movie that we didn't watch leading up to this. So I'm trying to think, it's been a while since I've seen it.
And I was going to ask you, is he timid because of what had happened and he wasn't sure if he
if he should get out
yeah.
there.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
a
yeah.
great question. I don't know if he was timid because of that or if he was timid because he couldn't believe what was happening.
Yeah, right.
Or if he you know, lived in the corn stalks and just felt safe there.
Yeah. So,
and, but that's a great question.
And just, I've not seen the movie probably in, what, 12 years maybe? 12, 13 years. Mm-hmm. So, and again, we didn't have time to get to it. But they didn't live in the corn stalks.
No, that's just okay. where they came from.
I'm like, come on now.
Yeah, they had little huts back there.
Yeah.
No, they did not live in the corn stalks.
So, I have a question for you.
Go.
Do you want to wrap it up now and make a mini-sode for the rest? Or do you want to power through?
How long are we at right
We're
now?
We're at an hour 20.
Okay. Yeah, then let's do a mini-sode.
Let's do a mini-sode, folks!
All right. Yeah, we'll do a mini-sode.
We're going into extra innings.
We'll hand out some awards. We're going to do the Oscars of 1980s baseball movies. And then I am going to fill out my lineup card by picking an all-star team from all five movies.
And Corbin Burnson's going to be like right up there as MVP.
Yes.
Okay.
So before we go, let me just ask you this. Which of these is your favorite movie?
I feel so stupid now because I've just confessed I haven't seen the movie in like 12 years. Field of Dreams.
Field of Dreams is your favorite? You know what my favorite movie is?
Don't. No. If you say The Natural, I will refuse to make the mini-sode with you.
Can I finish?
What?
It's whatever movie I just watched last.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I think, aren't we all kind of like that? Yeah.
And seriously, though, like I love all of these.
Yeah.
And I could watch any one of them at any time. And except for maybe Bull Durham. That's not my favorite by any means. But any of the other four, I can watch and be like, yeah, that's my favorite baseball movie. But then I'll watch another one and be like, yeah, that's my favorite baseball movie.
Yeah, I can see that.
So, that's, I guess we'll wrap it up here and then we'll come back with a mini episode later on this week.
So we'll be back. You'll hear from us again. But in the meantime, if you have not left us a review, please go and do so. If you like us.
Yes.
If you don't like us, don't do anything.
Keep it to yourself.
Just silently go away. What do they call that?
Quiet quitting.
Yes.
Yeah, you can quiet quit on us.
But again, we would really, really appreciate a 5-star rating and review on any of the platforms that you might listen to your podcast on. And you can always find us on social media. We are now on Threads.
Yes.
I don't quite understand the point of it, but I'm working on it, y'all.
So Threads, Facebook, Instagram.
And X.
You can reach us by email at childrenofthe1980s@gmail.com. We love to hear from you. We love hearing from our fans, whether it's good job, bad job. I like this one better. I like that one better. Let us know which one of these is your favorite movies. What did we miss? What did we get right? If you have any ideas for future episodes, we're always willing to listen. We are men and women of the people.
So until next time, I'm Lindsay.
And I'm Jim.
And we are
Children of the 80s.